the fifth kind.
I've never been off planet as far as I know. I've only actually seen these visitors a few times in my whole life. But their presence in my life is continuous. I have received teaching, and I do receive teaching all the time, to the point that my life is so completely different from what it was before this happened, I can hardly even believe that other life existed. There are millions of people all around the world who have been bruised and beaten up by this. The secrecy starts with them. It's their policy.
Before we get into it, our thanks to Surfshark VPN for sponsoring this video. VPNs, virtual private networks, are a really useful tool for protecting your privacy and securing your personal details online. Surfshark VPN is a service that protects your information by encrypting all the data that you send through the internet, keeping anyone unwanted from seeing it. Along with privacy and security, Surfshark VPN offers the ability to change your location with the click of a button, allowing access to sites, features, and streaming services otherwise restricted to certain locations. Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description, sign up, and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 3 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
Our guest today is a best-selling author, in fact, a world-famous author with 45 titles to his credit, including 5 TV and film adaptations, which include Wolfen, Communion, and The Day After Tomorrow. I'm talking today to Whitley Strieber. Whitley, welcome to the Fifth Kind TV.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. I should start by saying I'm absolutely blown away by how prolific you are as a writer. I think it's 45 titles under your belt.
I don't keep count anymore. You get as old as I am, you don't want to count the number of books you've written, and you don't want to count the number of birthdays you've had.
I won't mention the number again.
It could be 45. It might be more, might be a little less.
I wanted to ask, what inspires you to write, and what has driven you to keep writing so prolifically through the years?
It's my life. You know, when I was 6 years old, I wrote my first story, and that story, it was about the moon coming up over the valley in our country house in Texas. It was a six-year-old boy's story, but I can remember visualizing that moon and the world I made in the story coming forth. And before that, I had a little sort of a little viewing thing I had invented, which consisted of a plastic cookie jar with a flower pot on top of it. And I would peek through the hole in the flower pot down into the cookie jar. And in the cookie jar, I could imagine all kinds of cities and oceans and ships and planes flying. And it was my world. And I would make stories in that world, and this was the one toy I really cared about from the age of about 3 until I started grade school, and so story is part of my blood. It's in my blood. I love to listen to stories, to read stories, and above all, to make stories, to tell stories.
Yes.
And so that's kind of it.
You're known as a writer of fiction and nonfiction. And I should say that one of your books became my son's favorite film of all time, which is The Day After Tomorrow. And so on his behalf, I just wanted to ask you about that. What was the inspiration behind that? And is there a connection between the theme of that book, which was the coming global superstorm, became The Day After Tomorrow, and the other thing that you're well known for, which is as an experiencer of close encounters? What were the origins of that book, and is there a connection?
Well, it's going to take a few minutes, but yes is the answer, the short answer. The longer answer is this. I had become, back in the late 70s, I guess, concerned about the environment. And I felt like it was in trouble. And then in 1983 or four, I began working on a book called Nature's End. I had just published one called War Day with my friend Jim Konecka, who's a science writer, and about the dangers of limited nuclear war. And then I began working on this book, Nature's End, with Jim also, about the dangers of basically what we now call climate change. And it was obvious that it was a very serious problem. Now, then my life was rather rudely interrupted by a close encounter of the third kind, of all things, in 1985. And I had, to be honest with you, no idea that such a thing could even happen. And then suddenly it did. And I wrote a book about it called Communion, because it was a very intense experience. And talk about a storyteller's story. It was a fabulous story, only it happened to be a true story in some way. I've never been sure exactly how, but it is. And what I didn't expect was the whole thing just blew up in my face, and people went berserk trying to debunk it and say it didn't happen and I was a liar. And thousands upon thousands of people wrote us letters. I was on every conceivable TV and radio show on the planet, I think. And I was thinking to myself the whole time, what in the world is going on here? Now, that's part of that's the setup of this story. The next thing that happens is, fast forward through all of the communion stuff and the subsequent books and all the contact experiences and all that stuff, to a night in a hotel in Toronto, in the Delta Chelsea Hotel. Room, I believe it was 2545. And it's about probably 2 o'clock in the morning. And there's a knock on the door. Now, I am sleeping on the bed. I've gotten in very tired, very late from doing an author tour, doing shows. And my room service tray is still on the table. So I don't realize it's 2 o'clock in the morning. I think I'm not in my pajamas. I was just lying. I hadn't even undressed. I think it's like 10:30, and it's the room service waiter. I open the door, and this man comes in. He's a normal man. There was nothing unusual about him except that he was there. And then I realize it's really late. And naturally, my immediate thought is, I must get this man out of here. Because there can't be anything good about someone showing up in your hotel room at 2 o'clock in the morning. But then he started to talk, and it turned into the most amazing conversation I've ever had in my life. And a big part of it was exactly what became the book Superstorm, about how the climate is vulnerable to sudden changes due to the way ocean currents operate. And I have watched since that meeting, and the book I published about it a few years later is called The Key, and then Superstorm, and Day After Tomorrow. And then, of course, again, the scientific community scoffed at the Superstorm scenario until one of their leading environmental scientists said, in a big paper published with 11 other scientists, that the superstorm scenario was real, that it does happen. And quite frankly, where we are right now is the world is setting up for one of two things. It is going to heat up so fast that it's going to break through into a locked-in heat system. Or it's going to heat up to a point, and then the superstorm scenario will play out. One of those two things is going to happen in the next 25 years. I don't know which.
Yes. There seems to be a connection between your encounter, that conversation, and what I hear when I go to indigenous narratives, because many indigenous peoples around the world, when they describe their first contact experience, they talk about their ancestors being visited by beings from the stars who sat down and talked to them about ecology, talked to them about how to live in harmony on the planet. And it seems that what was a matter of survival for us back then has become a matter of survival once again.
There are too many of us to live in harmony on the planet now. It's as simple as that. Way too many. We can't. We have to go through this. And what we've seen in the human species is a population curve that goes up like this. I'm going to close my eyes because it's mirrored, and I'll go crazy trying to figure out where my hand really is. And then we reach up. We're right here at the peak of this bell curve, and then we're going to go down again. And that descent's going to be very rapid, just as rapid as the ascent was. It's the way nature works. And we're going to just have to live with that. That is our future.
In the communications that you're aware of in the present day on this topic, are we receiving anything other than a prediction of what's going to happen? Or is there some guidance as to how we can live through this?
If there's guidance, they're being very coy indeed. I don't know. There are this whole business of this presence that's apparently is really here is really difficult to pin down. I wouldn't say that I necessarily think they're aliens. I don't think we can prove anything about them one way or another. Only this. There are two things going on. One, there are UAPs here that the U.S. government has admitted are real and are unknown, of unknown origin. And there are people claiming close encounter experiences. But, excuse me. Are the two things related? This we don't know. We don't know whether the close encounter experiences are with creatures, people, beings that come out of these UAPs or not. Because there's no, we don't have any evidence connecting the two. So we're really at a loss there. Now, as far as warnings are concerned, there have been zillions of them. The close encounter community is filled with people who have been warned about the environment. And there are so many instances of intervention from these unknown craft in nuclear missile sites that we can assume that they have also been, we have also been warned about the danger of nuclear weapons. But as far as the environment, I'll give you the example of the kind of warning I got. At one point, I was shown an image of the world, the planet, on fire. And my son dying because of environmental collapse. And it was an awful image. Now, I didn't understand what the planet on fire meant. But now I do. And certainly in Australia, you surely do. And I mean, I live in California. We've had the same kind of catastrophes here that you've had there. Only yours have been even worse. So yes, the planet's on fire, and they don't even bother to put in the news the extent of fire in Siberia and in many parts, isolated areas of Africa, and in Brazil. They just don't even bother. But the planet is on fire now. But here's the thing. No one gave me any information about how to fix it.
Yes.
Just that it would happen. And what does that tell me? One of two things. Either they can't fix it, or they can't explain it to us, or there's something else wrong that keeps the whole thing out of focus, and they can't communicate with us somehow.
You touched there on close encounters in which you are shown things and things are communicated at that level, which is really intriguing because there seems to be always an element of the person's consciousness being affected, altered, manipulated in the encounter, at the very least an experience of sedation. But then at another level, people can come out of an experience thinking, what happened? Is what I remember what happened? Is what I saw what was really there? How do you navigate that? How did you navigate that for yourself after your first encounter back in 1985?
The experience is initiatory. And back in 1985, I did not know that. All I knew is that once I had exhausted all other possibilities, mental problems, brain tumors, temporal lobe epilepsy, or anything else that could cause hallucinations, and criminal activity. Once I knew that none of those things were probably involved, except for the criminal activity one, which I've never been able to prove one way or another, of course. I was forced to conclude that what happened to me was somehow real. And I kind of, because I don't know what real means in this context. Yes, they raped me. They beat me up. I was a complete basket case afterwards. But what it did to me was it overturned my entire world. Once I had gotten to that point and known that this was real, my world was that I had known before was gone. I didn't live in that world anymore. I lived in another world. And in this other world, there was a watcher in the night whose presence I couldn't identify, whose nature I could not understand, but whose voice was very clear, calling to me in the night to find a new life. And that's what I've been trying to do ever since.
The first experience you describe as an initiation, it was the beginning in a way of a teaching relationship. Who are we that our visitors want a teaching relationship with us? What's our place in the cosmic family, if I can put it that way?
Unfortunately, I'm still in grade school, so I can't tell you what our place in the cosmic family is yet. But I can tell you that I have received teaching, and I do receive teaching all the time, to the point that my life is so completely different from what it was before this happened. I can hardly even believe that other life existed. It's like having been 3 feet tall and now being 9 feet tall. I have a much larger vision of the world than I did then. I've never been off planet, as far as I know. Probably never will be. I've only actually seen these visitors a few times in my whole life. But their presence in my life is continuous and, in a sense, unfailing now. They will wake me up now at 3 o'clock in the morning, pretty much every night, by punching me on the shoulder, blowing in my face, or blowing on the back of my hand, or sometimes just more recently, just mostly just waiting for me to do it on my own. And then I will go and sit in my living room where I meditate, and I've been meditating since 1969, so a long time. And with them since about 1990, when they began to start meditating with me. And I sit in there and there's a sort of internal dialogue that takes place, which part of it is not me. And the reason that part of it is not me is I get all kinds of new information. And when I look into research and look it up, it's always correct. So that can't be coming from me. And I've written three books this way now: Afterlife Revolution, about my wife Annie and her spectacular return after she died. And the book A New World, about what relationship with them might be like if it spreads more than it has. And then another book called Jesus, A New Vision, which I think, if of all of these, most accurately defines the path I've ended up on. Because at first, in my experience, the visitors were harsh. They were harsh, and they did not treat me well. They treated me in a very indifferent way, almost like we would treat an animal in the laboratory, or, you know, gently as they could, but not nicely. In other words, there was no dignity in my side of the experience. It's very different now. The more I worked in my life toward really acknowledging the good in the universe and trying to live it as we have been taught, and not only in the Jesus story, but in so many other stories of around the world, to live the good in my everyday life and in my blood, my experience with them has changed and become a lovely experience. I'm no longer treated like an animal. I'm treated with affection and support and great persistence. They are, now that they are friends, they are really loyal friends, really loyal.
People are often surprised to hear descriptions like that, because we've gotten so used to the vision of Mars attacks or Independence Day or invasion of the body snatchers. But I've spoken to many people who, like you, describe this much more positive, nurturing kind of relationship. Is that because there's a spectrum of ET demographics in contact with us, and because of that, a spectrum of experiences going on?
It's a good question. And I don't know, first of all, whether or not we are in contact with ETs. I think that's a likely possibility. And if so, then they really evolved down a very different path from the one we did. Is there conflict among them? Are there some with less than positive attitudes towards us and what should happen to us? Well, there are a lot of stories, but there's one thing that suggests this may be the case. Well, two things really, but the most important one is, to in my mind, a crop formation of all things that appeared in England. It's called the Crabwood Formation, and appeared in 2004, I believe. And it consists of an image of a sort of one of the gray aliens with the big eyes, and beside it a disc, and the disc has kind of dots and dashes on it, which proved to be a coherent message in ASCII code. And this message says, "Beware the bearers of false gifts and their broken promises. There is good out there, or no, more pain, but still time. There is good out there, conduit closing." And the good out there as opposed to the bearers of false gifts suggests there's a conflict.
Yes.
And I think that, and that formation, you'll read all kinds of frenetic debunking of the formation on the internet, and it's all lies, every bit of it. The formation is not reproducible by any known means, even now, not at all. And I've challenged the circle maker community. I mean, you know quite a few of them. They're not active very much now anymore, but they were then for a while. And I would say, well, make the formation. If you say it's not, if someone made it, make you do it. No one would take me up on that offer.
No, indeed.
Because in fact, the formation is authentically strange.
Yes. Your first experience in December 1985 implied some kind of a hybridization process or experiment going on. How do you frame that story? It's certainly a very widely recurring story when you look at world mythology and ancient ancestral narratives. You can go anywhere on the planet and stories of hybridization will be told.
Yes.
At the level of the folklore. How do you interpret that? What is the meaning or the agenda that reflects?
Well, I think it's probable that if we've been known about for a long time, someone, and maybe more than someone, has been here and played games with our DNA. I mean, we'd do it if there was another planet where there were beings, and we weren't perhaps as all that concerned about their integrity, or we saw things about them that were desperately in need of improvement. Like we could change a few genes and quadruple their intelligence level and things like that. We'd probably do it. And then, of course, if we made mistakes, we'd come back, try again. And if there's conflict out there, one group might have one idea about what should be done and another group another idea. So they would do the poor species that's the chalkboard for this is going to get into a real tangle, and that's exactly where we are now. But look at us. Look at the difference between a human being and any other animal on the planet. I mean, is this a designed thing or not, with the hair on the head, or regretfully, it slips away in some cases, and then the rest of the body hairless, which compels us to invent clothing? I mean, come on, where did that come from? There's no other primates are hairless. So why are we like this? No other primates have no sexual seasonality. We don't have any sexual seasonality. We're ready to go at all times, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, both sexes. I mean, well, women have their periods, true, but they're always fertile when they are ready, and there's no season in which they're infertile, and there is no season in which men feel sexually inactive. And not only that, we have very prominent sex organs, and they're right out on the front. And we're naked, and we're smart, and we have excellent memories. So, of course, we've overpopulated the planet. And it's not our fault. And that's the main problem here. It's not because we were bad, we didn't do it right, it's because the vast increase in population starting in around 1700 until now has completely overwhelmed the planetary environment and the human species' best efforts to maintain balance. And we have made a lot of efforts. Now, I think this was done to us. I think we're like this because somebody either wanted it to happen, or made a mistake, or perhaps both. Or perhaps one somebody wanted it to happen, and another somebody thinks it's a mistake, and they're busy fighting over this out there in the Never, Never, and we're here with overheating. I mean, right now I'm in Santa Monica, California, where it should be about 50 degrees on a February afternoon. It's going to push up through the 80s today, and this whole LA basin is steaming. It's going to be 90 in February. In Australia, in February, 90, I'm talking Fahrenheit, by the way, folks, so it's not actually just bursting into flames. That's your temperature this time of year, not ours. We're in winter up here. What winter? I don't see it. It's gone.
It's very strange. We're certainly having very strange weather patterns in Australia these days, that's for sure. What you've just said, by the way, is amply reflected if you go to the Mesopotamian narratives or the biblical narratives, in the way I argue for in my books, that there is this debate among the others over how many human beings there should be on the planet.
Yeah,
it's there in the Nigerian story as well. Right from the beginning, we've been told there's this debate going on.
Well, they quit debating and finally sat back and just watched to see what would happen, I think. And what has happened is our population is completely out of control. All these wars we've been having, they're population wars. The militarization of the Germans from 1910 until up through World War II happened because they felt population pressure. They didn't know. Well, Hitler actually understood that, but what they didn't understand was that they would try to fight their way out. No one understood how hard they would try to fight their way out of what felt in those days like a trap, a population trap. Mm-hmm. Stalin's horrific and Mao's horrific instincts to starve or murder millions of their own citizens. They thought for ideological reasons, but it was actually population control. And I think we've got a gun to our head right now. I think that there is a very good chance that added to our woes with climate change, we could start to have wars that are essentially population-related conflicts. And so if somebody did this to us, they are responsible for somehow undoing it. And we see these ships, things all around in the sky. We have these strange experiences. But what we don't have is coherent support. It's all, if there is any, it's so far behind the scenes, you can't even tell for sure whether or not it's there.
Yes. Tell us what you're working on right now, the movie, The Observers, and how we can keep up with your work.
Well, you better start getting ready to run if you're going to keep up with my work. The Observers is a documentary with me, Linda Moulton Howe, Deb Caubel, who was the Kathy Davis of Bud Hopkins's book, Intruders, William Henry, an extraordinary, brilliant mythologist, Richard Dolan, Jimmy Church, a number of researchers, even Jesse Ventura, the former governor of Minnesota, is in it. And we're basically just talking about what this is and what it's all about, and what we think we should do and can do, and what may be true and not true. And it's the only place I know of where anyone's been frank about the possibility that there is a conflict about us out there. And that comes from Linda Moulton Howe in The Observers. And it's a brilliant, frankly, it's a wonderful documentary. And I think you can get it on, it's streaming. And I don't know exactly how the streaming services work in Australia, but I have a feeling you have Amazon Prime. I would be surprised if you didn't. Amazon Prime, and it's on Apple and Vimeo and other places as well. You just have to Google The Observer's movie and you'll probably find exactly where to see it.
Wonderful. And
so,
and tell us your website where we can find you.
My website is called unknowncountry.com. It started as Whitley's World back in I believe the year 2000 or 1999. And on the day of 9/11, my wife Anne back there and in here said, this needs to be a daily news website. And so it has been publishing news of the edge of science every day ever since. And it also has my show on it, Dreamland. All of the editions of Dreamland from 2004 to the present are there. And many other podcasts are there. But the most important thing I think about the site is it's a wonderful community. It's a place where people who have these experiences can come together and discuss them. And we don't allow trolls. There's no politics allowed on the site. That politics is not really part of this. And there's plenty of sites where you can go and discuss politics, but not this one. And it's a wonderful place. I love it. And I'm so grateful that people come. And I hope everybody comes.
How do you read the recent intensification of not only witnessed phenomena, but of soft disclosure, if we can put it that way? What's that about? Is that related to an incoherence or a conflict as to what should be disclosed or what should be happening?
Go to fifthkind.tv for uncensored access to the full interview.